Welcome back to the Deep Dive. I want to start today by asking you to just look around. Wherever you are right now, maybe you're driving over a bridge, sitting in a high-rise building, or even just looking at the frame of your car, it all looks incredibly solid, static.
It does. Unchanging.
Exactly. It's just, you know, cold, hard metal.
That is certainly the illusion that steel gives us. It feels permanent, like it's always been that way and it always will be.
But I've been spending time with this stack of research you sent over on kinetic theory and steels, and honestly, my whole perspective is flipped. Because if you could shrink down and look inside that solid piece of metal, it is not static at all. It is an absolute battlefield.
Oh, it is.
We are talking about microscopic crystals literally eating each other, high-stakes races for territory, and even mathematical ghosts passing through solid matter.
It really is a chaotic environment. I think most people view materials engineering as sort of a shopping list. You just pick the right substance from a shelf and you build your bridge. But this deep dive, this is all about time and temperature. It's about how steel changes.
And why it changes.
Exactly. And how hard it fights us when we try to control it.
So that's our mission today. We are going to unpack the chaos inside steel. We're going to look at this war of the grains, the reset button of recrystallization, and why, according to the physics in these papers, there seems to be this hard limit to how strong we can actually make this stuff.
And ultimately, it all comes down to understanding the why. You know, why does metal behave the way it does? And spoiler alert, it usually comes down to energy. Nature just, it hates excess energy, and steel will do pretty much anything to get rid of it.
So let's start with that war, the war of the grains. I think the most surprising thing for me in the reading was that when steel is hot, the grains, those little crystals making up the metal, they aren't happy. They aren't just sitting there.
No, they are definitely not in equilibrium. You have to imagine a piece of steel, like a 3D puzzle, made of millions of these tiny crystals or grains. And because they have to pack together to fill the space, they can't be perfect shapes. Their boundaries, you know, the walls between them, they end up being curved.
And that curvature, that's the problem.
It's a huge problem for the atoms. In physics, a curved boundary implies tension. Think of a soap bubble. The surface tension pulls it tight, trying to minimize its surface area. It's the same in steel. Those grain boundaries, they represent excess energy.
The atoms are uncomfortable.
Very. They want to move to a lower energy state. And specifically, they migrate toward the center of curvature.
Which leads to this slightly terrifying concept of cannibal crystals. The text describes it as a big eat small world.
That's pretty accurate. We call it coarsening or grain growth, but cannibalism is a fair metaphor. Because the boundaries move toward their center of curvature, the smaller grains tend to collapse inward. They shrink.
And the larger grains grow outward and consume them.
Yes. The big grains are literally eating their smaller neighbors to steal their territory, and the motivation is purely thermodynamic. By eating the small grains, the whole system reduces the total amount of grain boundary area.
Less boundary area means less energy.
Less excess energy. The steel is just trying to relax.
Okay, so if I just leave a block of steel sitting in a furnace, it's effectively digesting itself into fewer, bigger chunks.
Precisely.
And I'm guessing that's bad.
Oh, yeah. Generally, that's very bad news. In metallurgy, big grains are usually weaker, more brittle. We want small, fine grains for strength and toughness. So, as engineers, we have to stop this. We have to introduce a police force.
This is where we get to Zener drag, which, I have to say, sounds like a villain from a 1950s sci-fi movie. Zener drag attacks Earth.
He's the hero in this story, actually.
But in this story, he's the hero.
Or, it is. Zener drag is the mechanism we use to stop that cannibalism. Since the grain boundaries want to move, we deliberately put obstacles in their way to pin them down.
What kind of obstacles?
Usually tiny particles, little precipitates of other compounds that we mix into the alloy.
So if the grain boundary is like a rubber band trying to snap back, these particles are like little thumbtacks holding it in place.
That is a very, very good analogy. The boundary gets stuck on the particles. To break free, it would need extra energy, which it doesn't have. It essentially gets tangled up.
Now, the notes had a specific formula for this pinning force. Uh-huh. And I don't want to get bogged down in the algebra, but there's a relationship here that seems crucial.
It is. It's PSI is both 3 gamma VV2 or TERS. And the variables are what matter. You have V volers on top. That's the volume fraction, basically how many particles you threw in.
So more particles means more force. Simple enough.
Right. But look at the bottom of the fraction. You have ARR. That's the radius of the particles.
The size. And since it's in the denominator, a smaller number means a bigger force.
Exactly. That is the key insight. You don't just want stuff in your steel. You want a high volume of very, very small stuff. A million tiny dust specks will pin a grain boundary much, much better than one big rock.
But there's a limit, right? A scalemate.
Yeah.
The limiting grain size.
Yes. Eventually, the system finds a balance. The driving force of the grain trying to grow, that desire to relax, it exactly equals the pinning force of all those particles holding it back. The war stops. Everything freezes.
Everything freezes.
Yeah.
Until it doesn't. And this brings us to the oops moment. I love this example from the source material about the nuclear pressure vessel steel.
Right. A high-stakes application.
I mean, oops is not a word you want to hear anywhere near a nuclear pressure vessel.
Definitely not. This is a classic case of what we call abnormal grain growth.
So set the scene. What happened?
Okay, so in this steel, they use aluminum nitride ALN particles as the anchors, the Zener drag. At 840 degrees Celsius, those particles are solid, they're stable, they do their job, the grains stay small and uniform.
Okay, safe and sound.
But manufacturing isn't perfect. Maybe a heat treatment runs a little long or a temperature sensor is off. If that steel hits 940 degrees Celsius, just 100 degrees hotter, the chemistry changes.
What happens to the aluminum nitride?
It starts to dissolve back into the steel. But here's the catch. It doesn't all dissolve at once. It happens in patches.
So you lose the police force in some neighborhoods, but not in others.
Correct. And suddenly you have some boundaries that are completely unpinned. They're free. And because they're surrounded by these pinned small grains, they have a massive energy advantage. They just sweep through the material, eating everything.
Well, other areas are still stuck.
Exactly. You end up with what we call a bimodal distribution. You have pockets of tiny grains, and right next to them, these absolutely massive, uncontrolled grains. It's structural schizophrenia.
Which is terrible for a pressure vessel.
The worst. That variation creates weak points where cracks can start. Mm. It just shows how delicate this balance is. You're fighting thermodynamics, and if you slip up by 100 degrees, the whole structure can collapse into chaos.
So that's what happens when grains just grow.
Mm-hmm.
But the documents also talk about forcing the steel to change completely. Hitting a reset button, recrystallization.
Recrystallization is fascinating because, well, unlike grain growth, which just sort of happens over time, recrystallization is usually triggered by violence.
Violence.
Deformation. If you take a piece of steel and you roll it or bend it or forge it, you're beating the metal up. You are filling it with microscopic defects called dislocations.
You're stressing it out.
You're storing energy in it. The material hates this. It wants to get rid of that stored energy. So eventually, if there's enough heat, it becomes energetically favorable to just wipe the slate clean. The metal births entirely new, defect-free grains to replace the damaged ones.
But they don't just pop up anywhere, right? They need a place to start.
Nucleation sites, yes. New grains usually appear in the highest energy spots, so existing grain boundaries are the most common or near large inclusions.
Which brings us to my favorite technical term in this entire stack, pancaking.
It's a very descriptive term.
It sounds delicious, but I assume we're not talking about breakfast.
No, we're talking about rolling steel. Imagine you have a spherical grain. When you run it through a roller, you squash it flat, it becomes a pancake shape.
Okay, so why does this shape matter?
It's just geometry. Think about a pancake versus a sphere. A pancake has a massive amount of surface area compared to its volume.
So by pancaking the grains, you are increasing the amount of grain boundary in the metal.
Drastically. And remember, boundaries are high energy sites. They're where new grains are born. So by pancaking the steel, you create a massive number of nucleation sites. More surface area means more stored energy, which means faster recrystallization.
It lets us process the steel quicker.
Much quicker.
But I found a weird contradiction here. We just talked about Zener drag, how particles pin boundaries and stop things. But now the force says particles can also stimulate new grains. So,
which is it?
Ah, the particle size paradox. It is confusing, isn't it?
Fair.
The answer is it depends entirely on the size.
Okay, unpack that.
Small particles, what we call fine dispersions, they act as pins. Like we discussed, the thumbtacks, they retard recrystallization. But the big ones?
Large particles are different. Think of a river flowing smoothly. If you have tiny pebbles on the bottom, the water just flows over them. But if you drop a giant boulder in the river, what happens right behind it?
You get turbulence, eddies. All that swirling water.
Exactly. When you deform steel around a big, hard particle, the metal has to flow around it. This creates a zone of intense deformation, intense turbulence, right next to that particle.
Now that spot becomes an energy hotspot.
Yes, it creates a high gradient of dislocation density, and that intense local energy becomes a perfect nucleation site. So big particles stimulate new grains, we call it particle-stimulated nucleation, while the small particles pin the boundaries.
So in metallurgy, size really does matter.
Size is everything.
Okay, so we have grains growing, grains resetting. It's a mess. If I'm an engineer and I want to predict how fast this is all happening, how do I do that? Because if I have 1,000 grains all growing at once, they're going to crash into each other.
This is the classic impingement problem. If you just calculate the growth rate of a single sphere, the math assumes it can grow forever. But in reality, it hits its neighbor and stops. You can't transform the same piece of steel twice.
So how do we solve it? The notes mention something called extended volume.
We use ghosts.
I knew it. I knew ghosts were involved eventually.
Well, mathematically, we call it the extended volume, or VO dollars. The concept, which came from Avrami, is actually brilliant. To solve the math, you imagine a fantasy world where the grains act like ghosts. They can grow right through each other without stopping.
So you calculate a fantasy world where nothing crashes.
Yes, because that math is easy. It's just simple geometry.
Hmm.
You calculate the total volume those ghost grains would take up. Then, and this is the trick, you apply a rigorous probability factor to subtract all the overlap.
How does that even work?
Think of rain falling on a sidewalk. At first, every single drop hits dry concrete. That's 100% efficiency. But as the sidewalk gets wet, new drops are more and more likely to hit wet concrete. Avrami's equation basically asks, statistically, how much of this ghost volume would have landed on real empty space, and how much would have landed on space that was already taken?
It feels like a cheat code. You calculate the impossible to find the possible.
It's the foundation of the Avrami equation. That formula, XP, XP, X tape, or end goal, it governs almost everything in phase transformations. To a lot of people, it just looks like a curve-fitting formula, but it's actually derived from that very specific logic, phantom grains interacting in space.
So we've got ghost grains. Now let's talk about the race for territory, because real steel isn't just one thing turning into another thing. It's usually austenite, the high temp phase, turning into, well, a bunch of different options.
Yes, this is the simultaneous transformation problem. When you cool steel, the austenite becomes unstable. It wants to transform, but it has choices. It can become allotriomorphic ferrite, Widman-Stettin ferrite, pearlite.
And they're all competing for the same real estate, aren't they?
Specifically, the grain boundaries. That's the prime real estate where nucleation happens easiest.
So it's a race. Who gets to the border first?
It is. And the winner can determine the loser. Let's say allotriomorphic ferrite is fast. It nucleates first. It likes to hug the grain boundary and coat it in a layer.
Like painting the walls of a room.
Exactly. But here's the problem. Widman-Stettin ferrite, which looks more like needles or plates, it also needs to grow from the boundary. If the allotriomorphic ferrite has already coated the entire boundary.
The Widman-Stettin is locked out. It has nowhere to start.
Correct. The first phase to form effectively consumes all the good nucleation sites. This suppresses the other phases from forming.
So by controlling which one starts, you control the whole structure.
Precisely. And this leads to a really cool technique mentioned in the source material. Sometimes we want to force the transformation to happen inside the grain, not on the boundary.
Intragranular nucleation.
Yes. Think about it. If you let the reaction happen on the boundaries, you get these clear, distinct outlines. That can be a path for cracks to travel along. But if we can trick the steel.
Trick it how?
We can put inclusions particles inside the grain body, then we cool it in a way that encourages nucleation on those particles before the boundaries have a chance to take over.
So you force the party to happen in the middle of the room, not at the doors.
And you get this chaotic, interlocking microstructure of needles pointing in all directions. That's actually much tougher. It's called acicular ferrite, and for things like welds, it's the gold standard for toughness.
It's amazing that we can micromanage atoms to that degree. Now, to visualize all of this, engineers use these maps, TTC diagrams and CCP diagrams.
The time temperature transformation diagrams.
And these always look like a big C. Why the C shape?
The C shape represents the battle between two opposing forces. First is the driving force, how badly the steel wants to change. Second is mobility, how fast the atoms can actually move.
Okay, walk me through the curve at the top.
At high temperatures, the atoms can move very fast, diffusion is high, but the driving force is low. The steel is hot, so it's pretty comfortable as austenite. It doesn't really feel the need to change.
High mobility, no motivation.
So slow transformation. Now go to the bottom of the graph. low temperature, the driving horse is huge, the steel is desperate to change, but it's cold. The atoms are sluggish. They can barely move.
High motivation, no speed.
Result, slow transformation again. But right in the middle, the nose of the C curve.
That's the Goldilocks zone.
Moderate drive, moderate speed. That's where transformation happens fastest. And that gives you the C shape.
But here's the catch, and you pointed this out. TTT diagrams assume you hold the temperature constant. But in a factory, you're usually cooling things down continuously.
Right, which is why TTT diagrams are often academically interesting, but practically not so useful. For industrial processing, we need CCT, continuous cooling transformation diagrams. Real life is rarely isothermal.
And there was a rule mentioned, the Shale rule.
Yes, it's a mathematical trick. It lets us take the data from all those constant temperature experiments, the steps, and add them up to predict what happens during a continuous cool. It basically treats a smooth cooling curve as a series of millions of tiny little isothermal steps.
It's like stop motion animation. You take a bunch of still photos to make a moving film.
Precisely. It allows us to map the map onto reality.
So we can map it, we can control the ghosts, we can referee the war, but there is a limit. This was the final section of the source material that really stuck with me. The limit of perfection.
Section 13.2.2.
We always want smaller grains. Smaller grains mean stronger steel. So logically, we should just keep cooling it faster and faster, forcing it to nucleate more and more until the grains are nanoscopic.
And theory suggests that should work. If you balance the driving force against the energy needed to make new boundaries, you should be able to get incredibly fine grains at high undercooling.
But we hit a wall.
We do. In practice, with standard thermomechanical processing, we hit a hard wall at about 1 micrometer.
1 micron. Why? What stops us from going smaller?
The material fights back.
That sounds ominous.
It's called recolescence. You have to remember, the phase transformation from austenite to ferrite is exothermic. It releases energy. It releases heat.
So as the steel changes structure, it generates its own heat.
Yes. Now imagine you are trying to cool the steel ultra fast to get those tiny grains. The transformation starts happening explosively fast, and that reaction releases so much heat so quickly that it actually warms the steel back up.
It cooks itself to stop the change.
Effectively, yes. That internal heat spike reduces the driving force. It reduces the undercooling. The transformation slows down, the grains have more time to grow, and the refinement stops. You literally cannot cool it fast enough because the reaction itself is a heat source.
That is wild. The actual physics of the reaction puts a hard speed limit on our engineering.
It does. It dictates that with our current methods, rolling, cooling, forging, 1 micron is about as good as it gets.
So let's just recap here. We started with the surface tension, pulling on grain boundaries, creating this cannibalistic, big eat small world inside the metal.
Then we brought in the Zener drag, the particles that pin those boundaries down and keep order.
We looked at the ghosts of the Avarami equation, letting us calculate the uncalculable by imagining grains growing through each other.
And we saw that race for territory on the grain boundaries, where the first phase to nucleate really determines the entire fate of the structure.
And finally, we hit the wall of recolescence. The heat of the reaction itself, limiting how strong we can ultimately make the material.
It just emphasizes that high-strength steel is not an accident. It is a carefully orchestrated chaos. We are managing these kinetic battles to hit a very, very specific microstructural sweet spot.
It makes you look at a bridge differently. It's not just a chunk of metal. It's a frozen moment in a war that engineers managed to pause at exactly the right second.
That's a beautiful way to put it.
So here's my final thought for you to chew on. We hit that 1 micron wall because of recolescence, the heat generated by the steel itself. If thermomechanical processing is physically limited by the heat of the reaction, what completely new method would we need to break that barrier? How do you cool something that heats itself up from the inside instantly?
That's the billion-dollar question. If we can solve that, we enter a whole new era of super steels.
Something to think about. Thanks for listening to The Deep Dive. We'll see you next time.